Blog Talk Radio. Wonderful people, welcome to Madame Perry Salon. I'm Jennifer, host and cruise director here tonight. I've been telling you this week, I've got a guy that just scared me to death when I read his the first time I read one of his books, and but I'm still gonna have him on the show because if this guy can scare me worse as bad or worse than Stephen King, you need to know about him. But he's not here. I think he's almost here. I got a new setup here in the Madame Perry Salon. Over there where the little crystal beads used to hang, I've got a transporter. So he's outside. Yeah, just a minute.
Hi. Hello?
Lauren, you're with me here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, and you can hear me?
Yep.
Good. All right. Sometimes we have a little trouble here.
It was a bumpy trip.
Yeah, okay. Sorry about that. You know, we're still adjusting the technology. Anyway, welcome, and your author, Lauren Oliver, cooks up spine-chilling terror in Madame Perry's Salon, and you do both. You cook and you write spine-chilling terror. So I want to ask, what came first, the author or the cook, Lauren Oliver?
I'd say the author came first. I started writing when I was 10, so I didn't start go to cooking school until I was 30, so the writing stuff came first.
Okay, so if you were writing at 10, then I imagine that as, you know, even as a child, you were a pretty avid reader.
Not as much as I should be. I would read Sherlock Holmes mostly, and I wanted to read Stephen King, but he scared the crap out of me, so. So I didn't read as much as I should.
What else did you do? Did you read any other kind of adventure or fantasy or anything? The Hobbit or those sorts of things? Classics?
No, I really didn't like reading when I was younger, and those always took so long. And I used to pride myself in that I never actually read any books we were supposed to read in high school. But then after high school, I made myself read them all, so. So I read them all eventually, so.
All right, okay. So he was a rebel without a pause there. So when you began to write, in the beginning there was a... you said... were there, now, you're from Canada? Were you born in Canada?
Yeah, I was born and raised in the rural area outside of Thunder Bay, Ontario.
All right. And is your wife from Canada also?
Yep, she was born in the city of Thunder Bay, Ontario.
All right, city girl there from Thunder Bay.
Yeah.
I don't know about Thunder Bay. I know Thunder Road, but that's another story. So,
you go to Minnesota and head north.
Like that. All right. So tell us about growing up in the rural areas outside of Thunder Bay.
It's all right. Lots of animals. Do some hunting and fishing and get around by leg power instead of car power.
Mm-hmm. You think that, I think that, I feel sorry for kids that miss stuff like that, that didn't get to have that when they were growing up, because so much adds so much more to your experience. Navigate the world, I think. So then you became you. According to the information I read on you, you made a conscious decision to become a writer when you were 10 years old, and you asked the school
yeah,
library.
She asked if we knew any Canadian authors,
uh-huh.
And I guess I was a little more. I guess I was more outgoing then, so I said, put my hand up and said, me. And she told me to come back when I published a book. So.
Oh, I like that though. I like that moxie, that attitude. Yeah, me. And so, the same librarian.
Mm-hmm.
You were with her. And.
I was actually published in an anthology back in Thunder Bay, and she showed up at the book launch, so.
I'm sure she was
and
very...
She's actually a character in one or two of my books, so.
Oh. But is she aware that she's a character?
No, I have no idea how to get in touch with her, so.
Oh, okay. Well, what's her name? We'll give her a shout-out.
It's Mrs. Staples.
Mrs. Staples, librarian from somewhere outside Thunder Bay, Ontario. Tell her all about it. So then, was it a short story?
Yeah, it was what she read was a first chapter of a book that I don't think I ever finished.
All right, and so then, write your first novel.
My first first book I published was Red Island.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first in my Sergeant Reed series. I wrote it when. After I was done culinary school, my wife asked where I wanted to go, and I said Prince Edward Island. So we went there for some reason. And so... Sorry, I think I'm cutting in and out. Can you hear me? So I wanted the hero to be a police officer because... You still got me?
Okay, so Red Island was the first book in the Sergeant Reed series, and you have two series. You have the Sergeant Reed series and the Allcrest mysteries. I like that because sometimes when an author has a book with characters that are real, I mean, they really flesh them out and make them real with good points and with faults and just make them so human. Sometimes you get so attached to people, you know, you don't want it to end. And that's why I love it. Love the fact that you have the series of each. So the Sergeant Reed series started first. And Sergeant Reed is he's a Royal Canadian Mounted Police?
Yes, he is.
And did you...
when I wrote it...
Yeah.
When I wrote it, my wife was working with the RCMP,
uh-huh.
So I had access to actual officers, and I could ask them information and stuff. They might have told me more than they were supposed to. I don't know. So I tried to make the Sergeant Reed character as real as I possibly could, as far as the procedures that he went through and what happens at a crime scene. Nobody shows up in high heels or anything.
Huh.
Not like on the TV shows. And then at the same time, I wanted to focus on how a psycho killer becomes a psycho killer. So I alternate chapters between Sergeant Reed and the killer starting from when he's age 8 until he's 28 and crazy. So you get to see how he develops and becomes this nut guy killing people.
Well, you know, I like that because, yeah, nobody starts off, I don't think, you know, you don't just have a bad, totally bad character come out of nowhere. Not usually. You can usually trace it back. I read a lot of true crime and I follow, and usually when they explore the character of murderer, they usually go back to situations in their life that had a profound effect on their behavior and the way they thought and what they saw in the world and what kind of anger they may have had. So you can usually go back and trace things. Maybe people didn't pay that much attention to or thought somebody would get over it. And then if they've got maybe, I don't want to be disrespectful, but sometimes there is a way that people's brains are developed, not developed the way they're wired, that also will affect how they process certain information or emotions too. So, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes it's where they are and how they are living, and other times it's they are just a little off.
Yeah, and I'm going to say I'm certainly no brain scientist, but I like to read Scientific Mind magazine, and I don't understand it all, but they have some great pictures too and drawings, and it helps people like me to feel like I've got a little bit of a clue there. So now the Royal Canadian Mounted Police character, Sergeant Reed. Now, fortunately, as you said, your wife was working there, interning and working there, and so you had access to the people, to the investigators, learned a bit about it. Did you ride with them? Did you ever go riding with them? Did they put you on a horse?
No, I never had a chance. No, they don't always have horses. We did get another RCMP after we got here to Saskatchewan, got us into really close up with the mounted police ride. So we did get to see the horses close up.
That's really impressive. I think we have a few policemen on horses in Atlanta sometimes, but I don't think that lasted very long. Of course, they're also on bicycles too. I don't know what that's going to do, but
well, the RCMP mounted police ride, they go all around the world raising money for community that they happen to be in. So they do great things. I talk about them a little bit more in Red Surge, my second Sergeant Reed book.
Yeah, you probably can't tell me a lot, but I'm going to ask you anyway. If, when you were getting to know the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and getting insight into how they work, how they handle a case, what procedures they go through to gather information, create the theories, track a criminal, whatever, were there any particular cases that you called on or used little bits of in your books? Actual live cases that you knew about?
No, they wouldn't tell me actual cases. They would just tell me the procedures that they went through. I might have called in on a couple of cases that I might have read about in the news or other serial killers that might have done things. I might have added some of their stuff in there, but no, the RCMP were pretty good at telling me as much as they were allowed to tell me and not going too farther on after that.
Has anyone ever come to you and said that they read about something in one of your books that was pretty close to one of their situations and wanted to know how you knew about it? I mean, just by coincidence, maybe?
No, actually. I what happens with my books is I tend to write about something, and then just as I'm publishing it or like a week later, something happens that was similar.
Really?
Like when I started writing The Cistern, and then a short time after that, a girl in, I think, Los Angeles was found in a cistern. So it can get a little freaky sometimes.
That's got to feel freaky. Lauren? I mean, how did you feel? You know,
I was a little, well, at first I was kind of angry because somebody took my idea. but then I searched
just like
it out.
And I'm a true writer.
I searched it out and found out that it's a completely different story altogether, so.
Okay.
It's all good.
So you didn't sue the publisher for leaking anything or to, you know, to their whacked out brother-in-law
nope.
or something? Okay, good.
No, mine are all self-published, so the only person I can sue is myself.
Okay, all right, good. So that reminds me, did you ever see, there was a movie, I'm sure it's probably out before you were born, came out in the 70s, called The Eyes of Laura Mars with Tommy Lee Jones and Faye Dunaway. Did you ever heard of that?
Nope, I don't think I have.
Yeah, that has a similar plot to it. It was in the 70s, and that was the day, the big day of the supermodels like Rene Russo and Janet Dickinson, and Faye Dunaway is a fashion photographer who creates these violent scenes when she's photographing for magazines like Vogue, and then they end up having the models get murdered in scenes like that. And Tommy Lee Jones is the homicide detective. Trying to track it down.
He's fast anyway, so
yeah.
I'll have to check it out.
Oh, yeah, The Eyes of Laura Mars. Make a note of that. As
I
if
will.
You need to. So, have you ever had friends or relatives come up to you say that your book scared them? Like, I thought I knew you, but you just scared the dickens out of me.
Yeah, my mother-in-law doesn't, she's a little scared of me. My mother swears she, after reading the sister, and she won't do any baking.
Listen, so was your mother-in-law that way before she read the books, or?
No, she thought it was a little weird, but she wasn't scared of me, so.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to know. yeah, because I'll tell you, my mother. My family's been telling people for years my husband's trying to kill me. And I know. And we've been married 28 years. So I just keep saying, you know, after all this time, if they're still telling people he's trying to kill me, the man, he's a satellite engineer. He travels around the world. He knows a lot about electronics, electricity and stuff. If he hasn't killed me in 28 years, and God knows I've probably given him a couple of reasons to, you know, what do you say? Do you say, look, he hasn't killed me yet? Or do you just turn to the husband and go, can't you finish anything? You started the law, you started to kill me, whatever. You can't finish anything. So, yeah, that's good. Now, how old are your children? Are they old enough to read your books?
Yeah, they're 15 and 13.
Yeah, have they read them?
No, they've started them, but they've never finished them, I don't think.
They tell you why?
No, they're just not big fans of reading, I guess.
All right, that's fine. Well, when along the way, the Sergeant Reed series was the first series you began. Is that correct?
Yep.
All right. And then the Allcrest mystery series. Now, first of all, talk about what is the Allcrest?
The Allcrest, actually, the word originated from my aunt and uncle's place in England. Instead of like house numbers, they just had names for all the houses on their street, and theirs was Allcrest. So I took that and in culinary school, our final project, I had to make a restaurant, so I called it the Allcrest. It was an artisan's cafe. And then I took that idea and turned it into the Allcrest Gastropub in this series, and it's also the last name of the main characters.
Okay. So were you already a professional cook? Had you already been to culinary school before you began writing that series?
Yes, I was. And I always wanted to write something that had to do with the kitchen, and I just thought murder mysteries might be a good intertwining with kitchen life. I hope this shows a little bit of how the kitchen life is, all crazy and weird. I will warn people, there are swear words. Kitchen people swear, so.
Well, you know, when in Atlanta, we're very proud of our celebrity chefs, or our chefs. All of our chefs to us are celebrities and restaurants. Mm-hmm. And for a time, I was working with the Vistra Center, Convention and Vistra Center at the World Congress Center. And so when we would send people who were in town for big conventions, we would send them to restaurants. And the restaurants and the owners, the chefs, would invite us out to have dinner there, learn about them, the chefs, the restaurant, their food, how their service. And so I was beginning to learn a lot more about the culture, about the business of the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And the culture of the chef. And just became, it's one of those things that once you start to learn about it, you know, food just means something entirely different. Food, the restaurant, the service, and you see your chef and your servers and bartenders, everyone in the restaurant, you just see in a whole new light. You know, you just cherish them, and we actually, you know, we exalt them, and we love them for, you know, with their imagination and their training and the way they come up with the foods and the recipes and service. You know, we love it. So yeah, I think that's it's like a little subculture or world almost, not completely a subculture. Help me out here, Lauren. What am I trying to say? It's a very special world into itself with its own ways and means. It's a lot more work. Pardon?
We're economic rock stars.
Yeah. And in Atlanta we have chefs that, you know, some have been on major TV shows, some haven't, but we, you know, we love them all. And
one of my favorite chefs is from Atlanta.
Oh, who's that?
Richard Blaze.
Yeah, Richard Blaze. I saw him, the other day he was on a TV show. It might have been, and I was in a restaurant in Asheville looking up. I said, there's Richard Blaze. I'm there. Yeah, Richard Blaze. And we have a lot. Tom Colicchio. I love a restaurant called Agave. And the owner is Jack Sobel, and that's more Southwestern food. But, yeah, you take food more seriously once you learn about it and how it's made and the chefs. And so, therefore, you've got this world, this whole different culture of the world of the restaurant and the clients and how it all fits in, you know, your people that come. And then to put a murder mystery in there. I mean, you know, people say write what you know, but if people wrote what they knew, you know, we wouldn't have science fiction and fantasy. However, you know the food business and restaurants. Obviously, you know a lot about people, and you learn a lot about crime and solving crimes from professionals. And so then how did this all come about, you know, to put there?
I started with the characters. The main characters are Chris and Spencer, and I had the name Chris a long time ago, which is short for chrysanthemum. And I had the story idea too, because my wife had a job cleaning out foreclosed houses, and we went into a house, and down in the basement was this concrete room that we didn't know what it was. Had no doors, no windows, just a trap door on the top. Turned out it was a cistern, which just collects rainwater. Here in Saskatchewan, all kinds of houses have them. And in my mind, I put a person in there and just kept developing the story. And then I just thought, well, I wanted to write about restaurants, so let's throw these two characters who are brother and sister but opposite to each other and give them a restaurant, see what happens.
I really like the way when it played, you had these extra little characters in there. One seems like kind of a gangland type. That some people
all my books take place in Canada because I love my country, and like you said, write what you know, but I decided to put them on the complete opposite coast as the Reed series, so I put them in the city of Vancouver, except I've never been to Vancouver, so I renamed it Middleton because I believe it was the royal wedding, so I named it after the Kate Middleton. I just thought, you know, why not have a gangster on the docks, and he can somehow be related. And I keep throwing in the past of Chris and Spencer's father, and hopefully people will keep reading on to try and figure out what was going on way back a long time ago.
I like that. I like a little depth in the background there, a little texture in the background. So I've got a question here from one of my favorite folks here, Mr. David Hurley, who is also an author and poet and the publisher of Subtlety Magazine. And he has a question. He says, is Lorne into true crime? With the recent death of the... Go ahead.
I like watching shows about true crime. But like I said, I'm not a big reader, so... which is really the complete opposite of what I should be. My wife loves true crime, so we're always watching stuff about it.
Yeah, because he says, with the recent death of the great Ann Rule, her stuff is on my mind. Her books on the Green River Killer and Ted Bundy, who she knew personally because they worked at a suicide hotline job in the 70s, are riveting. And you know what, David, that's the only book of hers that I haven't read. It's the one, A Stranger Beside Me. But he says, Patricia Cornwell detoured from her crime fiction to brave speculation on the real identity of Jack the Ripper. So I ask, with all your interest and fictional expertise in murder and horror, do you think you would ever take on a book about true criminal events? Are you into Ripperology at all, by the way?
I was a long time ago. I haven't really paid much attention to it. And I have Stranger Beside Me in my bathroom, actually.
Wow.
I would love to get into true crime and write a real story, I guess you could call it. Just nobody will let me.
What?
I've tried getting in on autopsies and they just won't let me. But I would be happy to look into, there's, strangely enough, Saskatchewan has a few murders, so I would enjoy trying to solve them myself and see if I can write about it and hopefully not become a suspect.
Yeah, really. That's I don't know if you've read anything by the author Simon Wood. He was a race car driver, a British guy, race car driver, but he also writes a lot of mysteries and he's talked about that, about sometimes when he's went out and enacted certain scenes that are going to be in his books to see how long it would take or how the problems. And I said, well, you know, Patricia Highsmith had a book like that where the man's trying to see, like, he's going to, how it would work if the person in his books killed his wife, rolled her up in the carpet and took her out in the woods and buried it. You know, how difficult would it be? How long would it take? At the same time, this guy's wife decides just to take off on a little trip and not tell him. So everyone in the city is saying she's not here. We saw him take a carpet out in the woods. We saw him bury it. You know, people are scared of this guy and think it's him. Simon Wood says, oh, yeah, if anything happened to my wife and somebody went through my computer to see what I've been looking up, I'm dead. You know, that's it. It's over.
Yeah, I call it method writing because I do it too. I recently went to a shooting range so that I could see what it's like to shoot handguns. And I just finished writing. It's in the editing stages now. It's called The Menu. It's the second Allcrest mystery. In there, somebody, I think it's Chris actually, grabs a pineapple and hits somebody in the head. So I was trying to get one of the guys at work to let me hit them in the head to see what would happen with a pineapple. But there's certain labor laws that I can't do that, so...
You would like a padded helmet you couldn't offer him or something. So,
no, the some of them were willing if I bought them a pop though. So,
okay, see, that's something you could work with. Well, I got to tell you, my first husband was a homicide investigator for DeKalb County. So, if you're ever, he's retired from that now. But if you're ever in Atlanta, I'm sure he could get you into an autopsy if you like. Just saying.
All right.
You, And then, of course, I'm sure then with all that, and you know about all the gallows humor to kind of get along with the stress of that stuff. I think he used to do the drawings. He was an artist in the Identikit drawings, and somebody had him. He was on a ladder once looking down at someone who had been in a lake for a while trying to help reconstruct the figures, her face in the sketch. And one of the women detectives there would come by and shake the ladder a little bit. So, you know.
Yeah, I always got to put some fun stuff into it. And that's what I try doing with these books is the characters are real and it's a real situation, but they still got to live through it some way. So they have some fun and chat about things at certain times when they shouldn't.
Yeah, because that's the way it's, that's exactly the way it happens. That keeps it real, and that's one of the things that I like a lot about your books is that, because I would normally rather read true crime or true stories or biographies or memoir, but than fiction. But I love your books because you make it so real. Like I said, when I started The Cistern, it's like I got a few chapters in, it's like, oh my God, I got to stop. No, I got to go back. No, I got to stop. No, I got to keep on finding out what happened. No, I got to go. You know, and it really pulled me in more than most people ever do. So, yeah, you have all those nuances with this plot and the situations that happen in the character. You know, when you've got me talking to the iPad, Lauren, that's when you had me, okay? I'm talking to the people. I'm talking to the story. I'm talking to you. And they're, what are you doing here? So, yeah, that's pretty legit. Well, I'll tell you what, if you're listening and you want to talk to Lauren Oliver, ask him a question about how he writes, about his books, about Canada, or about cooking, give us a call here. The number is 646-716-9922. And so right now, Lauren, I'm going to let you get a drink of water or something, and I'm going to say thanks to some very nice people who are supporting this show and helping to keep me going. Okay, so I'll give you about 5 or 6 minutes. Get a glass of water. Go throw a pineapple at somebody.
Hi, Jennifer Perry here from Madame Perry Salon. I want to tell you about Scratch. Scratch is a brand new, free computer programming application that allows children 10 and up to express themselves creatively by developing their own stories, cartoons, games, and more, all while learning computer programming. Scratch is a self-study program created by father and son team Dennis and Artem Bilikoff that teaches children all about computers and programming in some of the most fun ways possible. Complete with cartoon animation, Scratch allows children to interact and play with various objects on the screen and then develop forms of interaction between them. Think of digital multicolored blocks kind of like Lego. Each chapter consists of 20 to 30 minutes of study and covers topics like how to make funny cartoons and games. So give your child an insight into one of the fastest growing fields in the world and let them have fun at the same time. So you can choose Scratch today. And if you want to know more about Scratch, and it is available on Kindle, come to the Madame Perry Salon page on Facebook or look here on this page on Blog Talk Radio for this episode that you're listening to now. And I'll have information, the links of the website, and where you can purchase Scratch.
All right. Hey, here's another thing, too. And thanks. Yeah, go check out Scratch. In fact, and I know it says it's for kids, you know, around 10 and up, but I think I'm going to check that out myself and get one. You know, sometimes we want to get that little special gift for somebody, something nice to make them feel good about themselves. I bet you're looking for a gift right now for someone. Tiger Lily Soaps is a company I just found out about. It's an online store offering a wonderful assortment of handmade soaps, lotions, body butters, bath bombs, and bath salts. Bath bombs, if you haven't heard of those, I don't know if these are in Lauren's books or not, but a bath bomb is it's about the size of a softball, and when you put it in the water, it fizzes up, so you have lots of bubbles and fizz and all kind of things that make you feel good, make your skin soft. Use it something with aromatherapy, very relaxing. And just listen to some of the fragrances that she has on these. She has the lady that makes these, Jessica, hydrangea rose goat's milk soap, black raspberry vanilla body butter, bay rum soap, spearmint rosemary bath bomb, jasmine lime bath salts. That sounds heavenly. Lavender lotion, and that's just part of it. So you go to her website, tigerlilysoaps.com, and she also usually has a deal of the day. Now, these are all tested, and they're all natural ingredients, but she always has some kind of a special deal every day, and she'll tell you what's in the products as well. So check out Tiger Lily things. Also, I found out a lot of people here are pet lovers, just like Madam Perry. A lot of my Facebook friends, we all love our dogs and cats and our critters. If you're like me, I'm living down here in the humid, hot South, hot Atlanta, the ATL. Sometimes I've got to go and leave my dog for a while. I had my air conditioning was quit working. You don't want your little pets wearing the fur-covered suits in the heat to get all overheated and not have cool water. First of all, because you love them, because they're thirsty. And besides, if you don't have cold water for them, you know what they're going to do. They're going to go find the good stuff, lift up the lid, if they're tall enough. Minor corgis, they're not tall enough. They'll just take up the toilet. But anyway, there's a guy named Jerry Collins. Jerry Collins has invented something. It's a bowl that keeps the water cold 24/7. His company is called Tails and Chills. Let me just tell you about it. He says dogs need refreshing cold water, and he has a campaign into the marketplace, but he needs your help. No matter what the this new cold bowl technology will keep your pet's water bowl the perfect temperature, 40 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. He's got two models proposed, a corded version for use at home and a cordless version for use on the go. Tails and Chills 24/7 bowl will be appreciated by any that are not air conditioning or that may not have access to electricity. He's also got a third model he's created. So it's on Indiegogo. What I've got here, if you're looking on the page for the page here on Blog Talk Radio for the show, I've got the list of all our sponsors and a link to the website. So if you want to go to Tails and Chills, that's the name of Tails and Chills, and support the 27/4 Bowl for Pets, help this guy get it built and mass-produced and on the market for us, that's there. And also for Tiger Lily Soaps, Scratch 2.0 programming. I've got links right there for them. And I am so grateful to them for helping to promote my podcast and for you for listening. And I found out about another podcast that's pretty cool. It's called Comcastro. Now, that's just kind of a strange name in itself, Comcastro. Counts itself as a geek culture podcast. It's so much more. Once I got into reading about this, just reading about the people who put this together sold me on it. Comcastro is the name, is a bit of a, not even a bit, it's a total slam, a slur, a put down on Comcast, but working in Castro into it. And if you have ever cursed Comcast like my ex-boss always did, you'll get it. But anyway, Comcastro, I'm not going to tell you the whole thing on that. You're going to have to go to the webpage and see it. Comcastro.com. Comcastro is a daily talk show podcast. They invite, let their guards down and really dig into the guts of every topic imaginable. Digging into the guts, that sounds like something that's a show that you should be on, Lauren.
Maybe.
I should pitch you for that, or you should pitch yourself. One of us should. But they dig into the guts of every topic imaginable, intelligent, irreverent, funny, and philosophical. The conversation takes on a life of its own. Yeah, I think you and I both belong there. Well, the intelligent part, okay, that'll work for you. But it says a few of their notes. No?
Sometimes.
Oh.
Certain subjects.
I think a lot. You know, it's a few of their notable in the past have been Rachel Haywire, who's the founder of Trigger Warning, psychedelic therapy researcher Neil Goldsmith, Florida Libertarian U.S. Senate candidate Augustus Invictus, Matthew McCall from iZombie and Tomorrowland, and they've also had on their cybersecurity expert Richard Steinen, who was the author of Surviving Cyberwar. And I also saw they had one of my favorite comedians on there, Chris Mata, M-A-T-A. They had him on there. So they have comedian, and he's not the only comedian they've had. And they're also going to be covering Dragon Con in Atlanta on September 4th through the 7th. So, yeah, so look on my page here, Tiger Lily Soap, Scratch 2.0 Programming, Culture Podcast, and Tales and Chills 24/7 Bowl for Pets. Yeah, I think you and I should go over there and just crash a Comcastro podcast. What do you say? I think they'd be very welcome.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, we'll do that. We've got a plan. All right. So, back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, do you feel that being Canadian has a bearing on the way you write or what you write? More than just the setting of the books and the mounted police.
I don't think it has a bearing on what I write or anything like that. We're about as close to Americans as we can get, except we're just more polite. Sometimes. Some people. And I've lived all the way across our country, pretty much, and everybody's different everywhere you go, and I just like it up here. It's nice.
It is nice. I've only been to Canada once, and I'd like to go back. It is very nice. I'd like to go back when it's not a camping trip with my family. Do you want to hear... Would you like to hear about my trip to Canada?
Sure.
Oh, I can tell. Okay. All right. I think somewhere when I was about 10 years old, we had a class teacher that wanted that was in the 10th grade class to go camping. So, with families to go on this big camping trip. They did. After that, my parents were so into camping. And my brother's a Boy Scout, you would think that would have been enough. But no, we had to go camping all the time, every vacation. And so one year that we went up the east coast from Atlanta into Montreal. Okay, so I've got to sit in back with my brothers fighting and all kind of stuff going on. And I'll spare you those details. You'll have to read about that in my book. But we get to Canada, and my parents are riding around, I guess, sort of get out of the way, and to areas where there's more French spoken, all the signs are in French. And where my parents live, although we grew up in Atlanta, my parents were from more country, but a lot of people back then, in the city and outside the city, liked decorating with these big milk cans. Mm-hmm. And they would get a can, maybe have like a picture painted on the front, maybe some flowers, maybe a goose with a bow around its neck and a straw hat, you know, stuff like that. I don't know why. They just seem to be part of the, you know, little country decor. So we get riding. My folks get lost, and they go up the street. And you're probably going to know exactly what's going to happen. They see this house with the milk can on the front and a number on it. So that's where they had two. They had the same number. And I said, oh, those people got a milk can for sale. Maybe we should stop. Well, we'll turn around. Well, they go down the road. And as they get down the road, the numbers get lower and lower. And they go, well, you undercutting them. Now, you know what's happening, don't you?
I think so.
Okay. How about this? Says, well, just pull up in the driveway at the end. That's the lowest number. So they go up there, and of course the people speak French. And so my dad's trying to point the can and give him some money, and the guy's waving his no and just saying no. And he keeps trying to, and he won't give it to him. They keep knocking on the door of these people and trying to hand him money and point to the milk can. People keep, in French, saying something to them, and they're going no. Finally, my dad just turns to one, and he raises his fist, and he says, well, if you didn't want to sell the goddamn thing, why'd you put a goddamn price on it? And, Lauren, what were those prices on the milk cans?
I'm guessing that was the number of the house.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing they had their milk delivered in those. This was in the 70s.
Oh, that was a long time ago.
All right, don't rub that in, but still. Okay,
yeah,
I was just a toddler then. I barely remember it, okay?
If I was on that trip, I probably would have come up with other things were in the milk cans and not so nice things.
Yeah. You might want to. If that turns up in a book, I want to nod somewhere, okay?
I often tell people anything you tell me, say, or do will be in a book somewhere at some point in time.
So, okay.
You've been warned.
Okay. Hey, Lauren, what are your favorite things about your books? I know what my favorite things about your books are. What are yours?
Well, my favorite things are if you read Stephen King books, there's always seems to be a character or a place that pops up in some of his other stories. For instance, there's Randall Flagg from The Stand, and he will pop up in some other stories as this dark character. So what I like to do with my books is put things that link up to all the other books. So, for instance, in Red Island, at the beginning, Reed's wife is reading a book called Just by Accident, which is a romance book I wrote a long time ago, but I still haven't published it, so there's still plans on that. And then in there's a character called Maeve Campbell, who in The Cistern, she's a singer-songwriter selling her CDs at a farmer's market that Reed and his family go to. And then she shows up in The Cistern as a victim.
Okay, yes.
So I like to have little hidden things that hopefully readers will find and go looking for.
Something? Do you ever get stumped and need to go? What do you do to work out of a rut, or when you need to? When you're seeing when you're at an impasse or something.
Usually, I just put the writing down for a while, and I just keep going, and the characters talk to each other in my brain, which some people think is crazy. And then eventually, they just work it out, and they come up with the solution to the whole problem.
Now, when your characters are talking to one another, you don't accidentally say their lines out loud, do you?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
The killer in Red Island, for instance, he liked his favorite victim was a woman with a tattoo on the back of her shoulder. So summertime, women are wearing thin straps on their clothes. If I see a woman with a tattoo on the back of her shoulder, I will mumble out, "Oh, I could kill her." It's not me. It's the bad guy. So it's not my fault.
Okay. All right. And no one. So. I would guess then that you see these people in public. Does your family walk pretty far away from you or your friends at those moments?
Sometimes. My family's gotten to expect it, though, so they're not too weirded out by me, and I try to say it as quietly as I can.
Okay. Was publicist for his book, Joe P., which is being shot for a film. I've had him on a TV show the day before, and then he was there. And I walked away from him, and I came back. He said, "I am so surprised at how many people just walk to themselves by themselves." I'm just really shocked. I do that all the time. And then my husband will stop me and he'll say, "You know you do this. You know this." I said, "Well, I'm sorry, does it bother you?" He goes, "I just don't want you to be out and then realize you've done it and be embarrassed if people hear you." I said, "I hear people do it all the time. First in Marshall and Iraq, and then I could wear this or something. Just whatever." And I'm not talking about people with the blue thing for the
I do a little nod and go on. Of course, it's nothing like I could kill.
I sometimes take it to the next level. If you follow my the All Crest Mysteries, I actually have conversations on there between the characters talking about some weird topic of the day, and I just keep doing all their words, and hopefully somebody else will join in on the conversation so that I'm not just talking to myself.
Okay. Well, you know what? Maybe this would be a good time to talk
about it.
Yes. Lorne Page for the All Crest Mysteries. And I'm also going to have on this page, on the Blog Talk Radio page, Facebook page, I'm going to be Facebook pages and everything else. I'm going to put it on Twitter. All of you and just friend here who his on Facebook that I. Yeah, that's pretty cool that you do that. That a lot. What would you want? Who else would you want? Are you picturing your mind? You know, when you're not thinking, of, you know, killing someone, you see restaurant. I can justify that. Do you think about your characters and how you would want them to be on a television show and who you would like to play?
Oh, all the time, actually. I tend to base my main characters on actual people. Sometimes I have permission, sometimes I don't. Chris in the All Crest Mysteries, for instance, I was looking for an Aboriginal Canadian, but couldn't find one. So I found an actress called Elizabeth Francis down in Los Angeles, and I tweeted her, and she said she'd love to be the inspiration for the character. So the character looks a lot like her. So I would love for her to play Chris, because that's who Chris is.
And what is the actress's name again?
Elizabeth Francis. She was in a movie called Drunktown's Finest last year or the year before. It was really big at Sundance Film Festival. And she's actually in a web series called Her Story that starts on September 1st. And it's about transgenders and lesbians and everything that seems to be the topic of the day, which is actually kind of what my new book out in October is also about. So.
Okay, and that's the menu?
Yes, that's the menu, second All Crest Mystery. And I actually started writing it before transgender became a big thing in the media and everything, so. But guess I didn't write fast enough.
That I'm cutting. But I clearly enjoy. Yeah, so, okay, I have a question from David Hurley. He says, Anthony
okay.
Burgess. Anthony Burgess.
Somewhere.
Writing about such grim stuff, do you ever feel that? Or does it. The savage scene in Humankind?
Okay, you cut it out a little bit, but I think I got what the question was. Sometimes writing gory stuff can make me sad. usually I get excited, especially if it's a really good scene and it's flowing and I just want to keep going on with it. There was in Red Surge, a main character was supposed to die, and the main character is actually based on my daughter, and when it came to write that scene, I just couldn't do it, so I killed somebody else.
All right. Yeah, David says he as he's listening, cutting in and out too. So I'm so sorry, everyone. Sometimes it will broadcast. It won't be cutting out. So we'll see. If that happens, would you please promise to come back sometime, Lauren?
I would love to come back.
Oh.
I do have a new book in October, so I can always come back then.
Yay! Okay, and what day is that going to be?
I have no idea. it's still going through the editing process. Still going through the editing process, and I still have to develop a cover. So working on figuring out what the date is, I will say Halloween just because it's a scary thing. So, but hopefully it'll be out a little sooner than that.
All right.
And I will also say that Red Island is only 99 cents for download on Kindle and Kobo, if anybody's interested.
Which was the first?
Yes, that's the first book.
Available. You said. All right. And I messaged Hurley. Thank you so much.